Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today for the milestone of episode number 30 is Harry Powell. He's the Director of Data and Analytics at Jaguar Land Rover, and prior to joining JLR, Harry's led advanced data analytics at Barclays Bank, then advanced modeling at Betfair, and had a wealth of financial services experience from risk management to financial engineering, from private equity to investment advisor. Welcome, Harry.
Hello, Paul. Good to be here.
Good to have you as a guest too. Harry, we met when you were at Barclays, but you've held many roles before then. You've also been a guest blogger for Customer Insight Leader blog a few times, which we'll come back to. But I'm guessing most listeners don't know about your varied career history. So could you tell us a bit about your background and why you made the move from a leadership role in financial services to manufacturing?
So I've been around for about 25 years after university. I read physics university, left with no idea what I was going to do, ended up in private equity, in quite some high profile roles in companies in private equity. Did that for about 12 years. And then suddenly, sometime around about the crash, I kind of just wondered why on earth I was still doing private equity, because it didn't seem very exciting. Quite a lot of the people seemed quite annoying. You know how you just end up, sometimes you just end up doing things with your life where you know, you're still doing them and they still pay you quite well, but they didn't seem very fulfilling. So I took a couple of years out trying to become an economist, a microeconomist, found that that didn't really pay the bills. But at the same time, I learned an enormous amount about econometrics, which is trying to make sense of economic data. And I read that famous McKinsey article about how there were going to be loads of jobs in data and analytics and data science. And I thought, well, I can do that because that's econometrics. And that brings me back to my kind of roots in terms of quantitative science and being a little bit of a nerd at heart. And actually, I'm not that attached to negotiating sale and purchase agreements and working with management in companies to set their long-term incentive plans and in truth indulging their once monthly bolch or whine about how they're paid so much money but life is not as good as it should be. And I thought, well, I'll go and do something that was a bit more fun and innovative and entrepreneurial and allow me to work with younger, more imaginative sort of people. So that's how I kind of got into data science. And then, you know, why did I jump from financial services through to manufacturing? Well, I guess Jaguar is an iconic manufacturing company. Manufacturing problems are really interesting. They're so multifaceted. If you build one of my big things is graph technology, and if you build a graph of a manufacturing business, it's very heterogeneous. There's lots of different things going on that all need to be coordinated. Whereas in financial services, ultimately the thing that's moving around is money, right? It's fairly homogeneous in terms of graphs. So the information flows are perhaps more interesting. And then finally, perhaps a bit more sentimental. My family were originally Birmingham industrialists. And a big part of that kind of 19th century Birmingham industrial scene, certainly towards the end of it. I felt sentimentally that perhaps I should get involved in Midlands manufacturing.
Sounds a great career story. I have to say, you've ended in a fascinating place. I now have you envisioned on the set of Peaky Blinders with Harry Powell as the lead character. But one thing I'm going to pick up on, you mentioned graph technology was something of a passion of yours. I know it's a term that's increasingly used, and there seem to be more and more data teams these days making use of graph databases, as I'd call them, etc. I wonder, for those listeners who are not familiar with the term, could you just explain what you mean by graph technology?
Graph. So the first thing you need to put out of your head is a chart, a plot, or a diagram. Those are things that are graphical representations, picture representations of information. A graph in a mathematical sense is a network, so a connected set of nodes connected by edges, from which you can infer information, right? So nodes are information and the edges are the relationships between those information sets. Obviously, all information in the world is in some sense a graph, right? Or things in the world are graphs. We have physical relationships to other and physical relationships to other things. And those relationships can be represented in a graph. And that then allows you to put constraints on your data universe in order to then be able to resolve particular quantitative challenges, right? So if you just say everything's connected to everything, which it sort of is, you can never infer much about the world. But if you can say, well, that the main influence on whether I drive my car to work is where my work is and where I am, just making it up on the spot, then you can start constraining the universe to the point where you can start finding answers to things. Now, why does this then impinge upon the way that you store information? Well, historically, information has been stored really where we've just stored the nodes, right? Yes. We've just stored the kind of the what's, not the how's. And that's been fine because we've changed the way we've thought about data into only worrying about the what's, not the how's. But actually, if you think about a supply chain, or a fraud, you know, a network of fraudulent payments in a bank or something, it's actually the relationships that are more important in some sense than actually what money is being transferred or what the part actually is. And the traditional database technology just doesn't store it in a way that allows you to query it very easily. So in order to connect information together, you do joins. A join is is essentially a Cartesian product, so it's massively, and a filter, which is very inefficient computationally. So the things that the data structures that are very good for aggregations, right, the kind of thing that your financial director wants to do, how much money have I made this year, what's the average margin on a car, that kind of data structure is actually really useless when you're trying to do things that are operational, like if I don't have this part for a car, what other car can I make, right? That's a relationships thing, because you understand how the parts relate together. And so a graph database tries to overcome this by instead of learning the joins every time you do a query, it pre-computes the joins, which obviously takes a lot more space in your hard disk, but makes browsing and crawling that data much easier. On the other hand, it makes aggregation much harder. Was that too much of a technological answer?
No, that was great, Harry. Not actually, compared to other stuff I've read, a really nice, succinct explanation of both the benefits and the, excuse the pun, constraints of where a graph approach to your storage of your data and a graph approach might or might not be appropriate. Thank you. Thank you. That was useful. I just thought it was worth covering because the term's beginning to come up a bit more. I guess something you and I have talked about a bit more, Harry, you've contributed a number of guest blog posts on Customer Insight Leader that have had a very commercial theme, perhaps not that surprising given your background. Is that intentional? Do you think that data science and analytics people need to be more commercially minded?
Well, what do I think? So look, I got into data science, not because of the commercial side, but because I love the technical side. I thought, even just a decision tree is is magical, right? You take a bunch of data and you somehow out the decisions behind it. It's a beautiful thing, right?
Yes,
And at Barclays, my job was not massively commercial. We were trying to come up with the most advanced technical approaches that we possibly could. We were trying to see what was possible with data science in a financial environment. And we did some cool things. JLR was a very different challenge. So in some sense, I've had the commercial thing pushed on me, right? JLR said, come and do this thing, but we need money. We need it right now. That's actually been a challenge in and of itself. That's just as hard as the technical challenge.
But
people seem to be focusing on it less. So perhaps that's why I've been focusing on it a little bit more. In other words, you can see a billion blogs about neural networks, but how many blogs about taking those neural networks and making money out of them, right? That's the kind of key thing. I think it's an interesting challenge and one that, you know, I've been focusing on at JLR, so that's why I've been writing about it.
Okay, that makes sense. And I'm with you, Harry, on the maybe necessity rather than passion for commercial focus. I guess one thing that has struck me before, and it's maybe some of the driver for why I sometimes focus in this area, is I'm old enough to go back to having worked on AI in the like 1990s. Early 90s, and thus seen the as termed AI winter, when all that initial excitement about we'll all be using fuzzy logic and case-based reasoning as was popular then, genetic algorithms, etc., kind of went away because expert systems didn't live up to their hype. There was a great big kind of disenchantment with these things really working and, importantly, not really making money. And I guess I would hate to see all the current passion for data science, use of AI, analytics, etc., wither on the vine to some extent because we have a big disenchantment with this really working in the commercial world. Another example I'd use would be CRM, all the overhype about CRM systems that, again, never fully lived up to their hype. Do you have that same concern that we need to prove ROI? Go on.
Can I be a bit controversial, right?
Please do, Harry. It's the point of having you here.
There you go. Okay. So I have never met a data scientist who doesn't want to have impact. Actually, that's not true. I've met a few who like sitting in the corner, but I'll call them machine learning researchers. The good data scientists love having impact. They love people using their stuff. They build something and all they want to know is whether someone's used it and whether it's made a difference, accuracy or the precision or whatever they've got in testing actually happens in reality. They love that stuff. They really want to make an impact. And they're really proud when they're able to say, look, we made a £10 million or a £2 million difference to the company. That's been really, you know, all data scientists are like that. They really are. The thing, this is the controversial bit. I think the thing that stops data science making money in companies, it's not the data scientists, it's the people in the businesses, right? Oh. The people who are meant to be commercial actually don't end up being commercial, largely because, well, we can kind of go into that if you like, but I think selection processes in core businesses tend to be more about ability to deliver on time necessarily than entrepreneurialism or business acumen, and certainly don't tend to be good at abstraction. So what is the digital world? The digital world is a parallel of the real world, but in numbers. So you take your real business, you digitize it, you turn it into data, and then you make decisions with your data, right? And then you then reapply it to your business. You turn it back into the real world at the end. You action it, right? Now, so it's those two steps, from the real world to the data world, from the data and decision world back to the real world again. The ability to take the step from the data world back to the real world requires the cooperation of business people, many of whom do not have the abstract imagination or reasoning ability to understand how to go from one place to another. And that is in my experience, that's the thing that holds you back. So for example, at Betfair, you know, we had a whole load of business people who said, well, we want you to do AI, but we want it to exactly replicate the rather bad way we do things right now.
Right.
And of course, you then end up with something that's probably not brilliant. The thing that holds you back from impact, in my opinion, is not data science or data scientists, but the readiness of people in business to have the to want to learn. Right? They want AI to come to them rather than them to go at least halfway to AI.
I hear the challenge, Harry, and it's a fair point. I'll take up the gauntlet of being controversial back. In that, I guess I would argue. I hear that, but that's been true for generations and waves of different technical skills coming into businesses. Isn't the challenge to recognize that and to both educate those people and be able to communicate what you're doing in a way that they're capable of understanding?
So I would say definitely there's a meeting halfway. I mean, it's interesting. What was it? Was it Samuelson was the economist who observed the spending on IT or in everything apart from the productivity figures. It was this thing that basically said, for all the money spent on computers, we haven't become more productive. Yes. It takes a long time for these things to happen if you wait for people whose primary skill is following process to ask them to move into the world of commercial and entrepreneurialism and abstract thought. So I think, yes, there's absolutely an importance to do with education. But I don't think we can necessarily be too utopian about that. Some people are probably not born for the AI world, right? And So businesses that survive will be ones that manage those people out of their business and ensure that they have a leadership group that is capable of reasoning in the ways that are going to be required, in the ways that you'd have at Amazon. It's no shock that Amazon is a big company, right? Because they've grown a lot. Because they've managed to use the information around them to make good decisions. Yeah. And if you don't use the information around you to make good decisions, you're a company that's going to shrink.
Okay.
So anyway, I was being controversial, right? I don't think that everyone is going to survive. And I think that the companies that adapt fast enough will be the ones that recognize that some people are, you know, the education is a good start. But is an important part of the process.
Yeah.
But won't necessarily work for everybody.
Okay, I hear you, Harry, and I think it's a fair challenge that we have to face up to that evolution of business and that new skill set being required. I never heard it put before in terms of ability to have that kind of imaginative thinking. It's a nice turn of phrase. What you're looking for? I guess I'd still hold a torch for. I come across a lot of data scientists and analysts who really do need to strengthen their communication abilities. They have great ideas, they do great work, but they inadequately communicate it into businesses. They inadequately identify the application and the relevance of it, and they don't know how to collaborate effectively with people in the business to partner with that process understanding or that what's been learned by doing understanding, which I still think is a valuable part of the puzzle.
Well, in some sense, AI AI is a way of encoding the learning by doing, right? So you've got to respect learning by doing because it has that nuance and subtlety that rule sets often don't. One of the things about communication, I think, is that abstract thinking is not necessarily about knowing the names of lots of different methodologies and talking in gobbledygook. Abstract thinking is about taking a real world problem and saying, what's the essence of this? Right, that's quite an entrepreneurial way of thinking, right? What is the essence of what I'm providing? So when you distill something to its essence, you're making it more abstract, right? And then how do I think about these essential components of my problem in a way that allows me to come up with some scheme or action which will get me closer to my outcomes, right?
Yes.
Now, these are things that are divorced from the humdrum reality of buying and selling things, right, and moving them around, which is the kind of the core of business activity in some oversimplified sense. And it's not to do with whether you can talk about the gamma parameter of a you know, a neural network or how many convolutions. Of course, the world's going to get lost in that. But that's not actually where you add the value in AI. Mm-hmm. Like where you add the value in our AI, really, no, maybe that's unfair. Right now, AI is such a new thing that you add value by simply being able to compute some stuff. So okay, I'm only half right there. But in analytics and broader data science, you add value by problem framing. You add value by saying, you've got a problem, but this is the way you abstract it. This is then the way you think about the abstract information, and this is then how you apply the results of your abstract calculation back to the real business. It's not to do with should you use a recurrent neural network with a something parameter and a this kind of function, response function, all of that. No wonder the world gets lost in that. I would too.
Yeah, good point, Harry. Although it makes me wonder whether we're focusing for the development of technical folk in the right area, because I think your point before was to, a million posts out there about neural networks. Well, I think that comes from the fact that all the focus is on developing the technical skills, the coding skills, the technical knowledge of data scientists and analysts, and maybe insufficient on their thinking skills. I mean, you're touching on abilities to think logically, to think in abstract concepts, to distill, to get to the heart of things. I wonder whether you one think we should put more emphasis in training that kind of analytical thinking.
That's where I put all the emphasis with my team from my graduates upwards.
Oh.
Well, not quite. We teach them how to use Python in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
And it's all about problem framing.
Mm.
So for example, it's really, we have this thing called the problem structuring authority.
Okay.
And it's a way of, in an hour, taking a newish kind of business challenge and saying, do we really understand this? What are we trying to do here? Who would be doing it for? How would they use it? What data might we have that would allow us to do it? What's our hypothesis or our concept behind what we might try and do? You know, we'd really kind of kick the tires on it.
Yes.
A big part of the training of my guys is being involved in those conversations with really impressive guys who work beneath me, having them in those meetings, listening to the arguments, understanding how you take apart a problem and test it. That's the biggest part of the education that they get. And we take on, we've got apprentices, right? I've got apprentices doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, at an early stage, but being involved in that because it's all where we add our value is problem framing. And I actually learned that from Nick Hall at Barclays. You know, that was the thing that he was really, really keen on, and I agree with him 100%.
Yeah, great. Good point, Harry, and not sufficiently focused on. I agree with you. Correct. Okay, I wanted to move on to, you've blogged for us before as well on a couple of topics I guess I saw as very related. One, what you called the productivity problem or productivity puzzle, I think was the term you used. And you've also talked about how to avoid drowning your analytics team as the demand grows. I wondered, from your hands-on experience of leading these kind of teams, managing productivity challenges, managing the demand, what have you learned that you think is the most important lesson when seeking to improve your team's productivity without overwhelming them?
Ah, so Well, I mean, the little story I think I told in the original blog was that I arrived at JLR, and we had this team of a lot of graduates, and they were working on, 20 people were working on a project that I thought needed three. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? And well, what the hell was going on there was that, okay, they were quite junior, but they were being treated as if they were very junior. So no one was really listening to them or empowering them. They were being micromanaged by people from the business and from our internal consulting people, who didn't really understand a lot of the problems that were that they were encountering, and were sort of dismissing them as like, well, these are just graduates. What do they know about pulling the data out? And the graduates are saying, oh, we don't really work. And fundamentally, things were changing day to day. No one was thinking very clearly. And so we came up in the productivity puzzle with this idea that the most important thing you need if you're going to be working fast and to a high quality is clarity over everything you're doing. But agile people know this, right? User story. What's a user story? Yeah. It's about getting absolute clarity over each step of what you're trying to do. Clarity is really, really important. But we needed to do that much more than from just a user story point of view, because because from a user story, anyone can write some stuff down. We wanted to go beyond that into the thinking that went into those user stories, right? And so we came up with these three principles: simplicity, challenge, and ownership. That you try and get everything. Your clarity needs to come from just trying to do some simple stuff, right? Getting your head around. Perhaps it's going back to abstraction, right? Abstracting away to what is the essence of the situation.
Yes.
Challenge is feeling that no matter how junior you are, you can challenge. If something doesn't make sense, you challenge it. You don't have to do it in a rude kind of way. But you go, why are we doing it like this? Shouldn't we be doing it a different way? Does this really add up?
Yeah.
Absolutely crucial to what an analyst or a data scientist can do. And then ownership, feeling like everyone has a responsibility for getting something across the line. It's not just a matter of it's the data engineer's problem or the analyst's problem or whatever. So we had those three things. And it took a little while, particularly because there was a kind of, as with many cultures, there's company cultures, there was a culture of, whoever the big man is who says, do this, do that, you jump to it and you don't say no and all that. Teaching them to say no was a big part of improving our productivity.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. And something I consistently hear as well, when I train on using Socratic questioning to kind of get to what's needed and stop being an order taker,
Right. Yeah. Socratic question. Do you get to sit on some kind of bench and drink wine, eat grapes while you do that?
Yeah, and hope they don't poison me. Yeah. I was struck, I remember at the time when I read the article and completely agreed with your points about kind of ownership and empowerment and the removal of the kind of micromanagement. I'm struck now we hearing you, Harry, that whole focus on simplicity and clarity, like you say, it's really exactly what you've been saying before about this priority of problem framing. If you can get real clarity on distilling down to the core elements of that problem and the right way to abstract from the real world in order to address it, that seems like the majority of what you need to do.
Yeah, after that, it's just a matter of doing it.
Yeah.
But the projects I see that are absolutely brilliant and go super fast. Not all of our projects do, right? We have problems as well. Is when you can walk into into the stand up, and any member of the team can say, "This is what we're trying to do at an epic level. Yeah. This is what we're trying to do at a feature and a story and a task level." I mean, those are kind of agile things. But
yes,
this is what we're trying to do today. This is what we're trying to do over the sprint. This is what we're trying to do overall. And they're absolutely, they can say it very clearly because it is clear in their head.
Yes.
And then when they come across, a data problem or they're asked to do something by a stakeholder or whatever, they can evaluate in terms of their general view of what they're trying to do. And that, again, is underpinned by the general principles of what we're trying to do as a business, the strategy, the general principles of what we're trying to do as a team, as a data and analytics team. And of course, perhaps more importantly than anything else is our values. What do we stand for, right? What do we stand for as a team? And then you have these little kind of aide memoirs about how to deal with the world around you. You don't have to make it up every time. You're not improvising every time with a new set of principles or a new set of user stories or whatever. Everyone is completely aligned. And of course, if they're not aligned, by being clear, you can spot that and you can realign yourself.
Yes. Yes. And
possibly after a massive great punch up, but but at least you've had the punch up and you've realigned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear how much that addresses the old ways of feeling that was a need for command and control, there was a need for micromanaging, because once you've got clarity in everybody, once you've got embedded also the values and the principles of how you work and some repeated best practice just known as ways of handling challenges, you don't need that same control. You can relinquish control more and have the more effective way of working with empowerment because you have confidence about that consistent understanding.
Yeah, and you know, the proof of the pudding is that I'm probably not really needed anymore in my job because my guys are brilliant. Because they're really, really good, and they understand how to challenge each other. They understand how to be clear, how to drive value, and all of that stuff. I am, for example, there are lots of important meetings right now in my business because we're going through a transformation. I'm not going to, because I know my guys will be thinking in the same sort of ways. They'll understand what they need to report to me and what they don't need to report back to me. We've got complete alignment.
Good.
That's
to hear.
Very different to much of the rest of the business where, people of my level will feel they need to be in everything, right?
Yeah.
But all that does is crowd out the good talent below you and gives you less time to think, right? Let's go back to the abstraction thing, right?
Yeah.
It just needs a bit of time to think. How are we making sure we're doing things exactly right? You can't do that if you're endlessly rushing around trying to show that you're not being left out of any conversation.
Absolutely, Harry. Absolutely. And a theme that comes through often in my mentoring and coaching of leaders as well. So I'm with you 100%. I guess another aspect of the challenge leaders in your position have is this plethora of different ways of looking at the roles required these days. You know, I remember back in the day, it was simple enough that I was basically just making up the job titles as they came along because I found I needed a role now that did a bit less of this modeling and a bit more of handling those sort of data problems. I could just sort of describe the role and people got on with what the work was, but everyone was a different shape of analyst as a sort of Uber term. But now we've got data scientists, we've got data engineers. I look at your career history, you've got some data science, some engineering, some advanced analytics. Do you think these distinctions matter, Harry, or are we putting too much focus on job titles rather than people?
I'm going to give you a glib answer.
Go on then.
To begin with, right? If you can't be good at everything, you have to give yourself a job title that says you're good at something. I want all my guys. I keep saying guys. I mean, we're 40% women, right? So,
I
call them guys, right? Because,
yeah.
Because I'm lazy. I want all my guys to be good at everything, right? And they'll get there at different rates. But, and you know, some people are not going to be fascinated by the data engineering side or not mathematical enough to do the data science side. But we want to be as rounded as possible because no problem is ever a data science problem. No problem is ever a data engineering problem.
Yeah.
Right? No problem is ever. You've got to be able to deal with all these things. Now, it's true that people have certain technical specialisms, and you put teams together to work with that. And the way we cut the world up is really in four ways, right? We've got four different kinds of things. We've got data engineers, we're primarily about creating meaningful sets of data. So they are about the meaning of data, not just the mechanics of moving data around. They understand what the data is, but they're primarily about the pipelines of that. We have data analysts who are about finding meaning and finding meaning out of data and generalizing, understanding the causation of things, if possible.
Yes.
We have data scientists primarily methodological, right? They just happen to be more mathematical. They're more interested in methodologies. It's more of a niche thing. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is really capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. And then we have sort of change people who are, primarily interested in getting out, talking to the organization, not being an interface for the organization, but helping understand how you get people to change their behaviors in order to have impact the analytics. But all of my guys rotate through those functions, right? I don't think we have anyone in my team who hasn't ever done, a bit of each of those.
Oh, good.
And they're encouraged they're encouraged to think of themselves broadly as a member of the team rather than narrowly as a function.
Great. I like that approach. That makes good sense to me, Harry. I guess we spent a lot of this conversation focusing on your team. I'll use the term people rather than guys, given you're kind of getting there with 40%. That's good to hear. I'm interested in you. So if your team are focused particularly on this problem framing, their thinking skills, and that real clarity of understanding in the ways that they work, what skills are you still actively developing as a leader?
Oh my God. I still like to develop my technical side. Things going on. And I probably don't use it as much as I'd like to, I like to, I'm currently kind of doing Haskell and at home. I think that's important. I think it's important in a technical role that people recognize that you respect the technical nature of that role. You're not just trying to escape it and go to all the big meetings you can.
That's interesting.
You don't want to be the person who leaves the room and everyone sniggers and says, he thinks he's in charge, but actually he's got no idea what we do. I don't think that's ever going to really work out. Well, how else am I developing myself? I think at some sort of level that you start learning more and more about how to manage the people around you, particularly managing up and managing your understanding how to work with your peers.
Yes.
Is a really, really important part of leadership. I'm sort of finding my way in that a little bit. Obviously people come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and some are easier to get on with and some are easier to understand and align with than others. I have a pretty ambitious team immediately below me. And I need to find ways of channeling that ambition towards not just getting goals for the team, but actually getting those individuals fulfilled themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Glad to hear that latter point. I mean, I take on board your point about the continual technical development, Harry. I can understand where you're coming from there. But I think certainly from my experience, a lot of leaders who've excelled technically are surprised later in their career how much there is to learn about the art as well as the science of people management upwards and downwards. It's a never-ending journey, that leadership capability.
I agree. I mean, it's a I am much better at managing my team than managing the world around. That's where my natural heart lies.
Sure.
So I have to work much more consciously on the wider picture.
The start is that self-awareness, though, Harry, so that's good to hear. I'm always trying to protect a bit of time on these podcasts for speaking to those who are earlier in their career, because from what I can tell, I get about a 50-50 mix of listeners to this podcast. Welcome, listeners. Those who are a little older, maybe like us, are probably a bit further progressed in their career, and those who are younger and starting out. So thinking of those listeners who are maybe earlier in their data analytics career, given what you've learned on your journey, Harry, what advice would you give them as to what they should focus on developing in those earlier days?
Okay. I mean, look, I am, I actually talked to quite a lot of people younger earlier in their careers. As I say, we have some apprentices and some new graduates, and I make sure I spend time with those guys. people. I'm with those people.
Well done, Harry.
You know what? But as it happens, all our apprentices and all our graduates this year are women. How about that? By mistake. I mean, when I say mistake, it's not a bad mistake, but it's not. It's fortuitous. How about that? Let's call it.
Stop digging, Harry, and just tell us about it.
So I like to spend time with earlier stage people because I think that it's important that they know that they recognize their talents, but also that they recognize that there is a long way to go, a long journey. They need to see it as not just sprinting to learn, you know, three libraries in Python or a bit of R and then, you know, made as a data scientist. So what would I say? I always say it's a hard path, right? This is not about just learning a new set of jargon and going, yeah, I'm a data scientist now. I used to be a BI person. I'm now a data scientist. It's a hard path, right? I still spend quite a lot of my evenings reading technical books. Reading blogs. You've got to expect, if you're going to be part of this world, you've got to expect to be putting in extra time, not necessarily to, at your desk, you know, developing, you know, your latest project, but developing yourself. And you can't expect a company to do that for you. In the olden days, they'd say, oh, you're going to move into production accounting, right? We're going to, you know, you're already an accountant, but we'll take you, put you through a production training scheme or whatever.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that for data science. I know people say that there is, but there isn't really. You find your own way, and you find your own way of being passionate by putting in those extra hours, reading those books, doing those blogs, having your own projects, going to meetups, talking to other people. If you've, this is not data science, particularly data engineering too. Yeah, there are some attractive salaries out there, right? But it's not a part-time job, right? It's it's got to be a passion. You've got to want to be in it, you know, 24/7. That's what I'd say. And the other thing I'd say is try not to lose your maths. At some point, if you're going to be reading some of these things, you're going to want to understand something that's written in a book, and it will be... there will be some mathematical stuff in there. And if you just skate over it, you probably won't really understand.
Good point. Yeah, not something that gets called out that often by leaders on this podcast. So thank you for doing that, Harry. Final question then, and then I'm going to give you a chance to beat me up about something. But final question that I've asked all the leaders on this podcast, because I want to, again, really instill this understanding in everybody that leaders, even those who look like they've been really successful in their careers, are continuing to grow and change and evolve because we're all on these learning journeys. Can you give us an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years, something you now see differently?
Well, an obvious example is this commercialism thing, right? I mean, I think coming out of Barclays, I was absolutely focused on doing cutting edge data science, machine learning research, right? That was the thing that was really exciting. And I had a small team of really, really brilliant guys, right? Brilliant, both in terms of intellectually, but also just lovely people and beautiful cultural fit and all of that kind of stuff. And moving to JLR was a bit of a challenge because it was suddenly like, well, here's, you know, you've got to make some money and I was pretty bullish about that because I could see the world around me and I could see there was the opportunity to make some money. I guess what I changed my mind on is that I do think that having that focus on commercial outcomes is a way of making data science more fun.
Right. That's interesting.
I've seen so many sort of dead ends in... In data science, right, where people have been given what looks like a really, really cool thing to do, but you end up just wondering why on earth you're doing it because, is it going to make any difference? Profit is a way of knowing you're making some difference. And what I often tell my team is, over the last 3 years, we've probably made 100 and something million each year out of my team profit. And, you know, think of it like this, that this has saved a certain number of jobs. Let's say saved, you know, probably saved in the current environment, but certainly has allowed those jobs to happen. We've been, for example, we can then invest in engineering. That's an engineering salary, right?
Yes.
And, you know, if it's £1 million, that's 20 people, right? Yeah. If it's £100 million, well, it's kind of 2,000 people, right? And from those 2,000 people, you've then got probably five times more, right, people in the area that are maybe even more than that, five or six, seven times more. Let's call it five times more people in the area that are dependent upon what it is you have, what it is you've done. So by you know, and that is kind of an exciting thing, right?
Yes.
There's maybe 10,000 people who in the West Midlands who we don't know who they are. They haven't written us thank you letters or anything like that, right?
But maybe after this podcast, Harry.
I'm sure they're all out there listening to your podcast, Paul. The you know, and that's actually an exciting and important thing to do. It's not boring and oppressive and like, oh my God, I'd rather be doing I'd love to be making that money and doing data science, and we are doing some cool data science, a bunch of Bayesian stuff, some graph stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But that's an exciting and important way of looking at the world, right? That we are driving, driving value. And as a result, we're having a real effect on the world. I think that I have changed my mind on that. I am more excited by the idea of making money than I used to be.
Great.
Which, given that I used to be in private equity, is kind of an odd thing, right?
It is, but I'd love to hear it, Harry. And I like how in such a socially minded capitalist way, really, that there's this focus coming through that, it is about commerciality, but it's because it can be a weapon for making the world a better place. It's about, I find so many data scientists and analysts coming through the ranks, they're motivated by things like data for good, the data is for social good type work, et cetera. And I think you're right. We can overlook sometimes that commercial progress, being able to prove that you've really helped commercially with an organization, can be about social good as well. It can be about saving jobs, saving livelihoods. And that
of course,
matters.
In some sense, we're not making the world a better place because as a result of my team, we're now able to make more gas guzzling.
Well, you need to just make the electric ones.
Climate killing motor cars.
Okay. Well, anyway, I will also give you opportunity because I know you want this, Harry. Let me fess up, leaders. So, listeners, sorry, maybe you are leaders as well there. Back a few years ago now, Harry was speaking at a conference in Barcelona, which I was chairing, and he made the claim that his team would add 100 million of profit. And I must confess, I laughed. I laughed at him on stage. So, Harry, have your revenge and gloat now.
I'd never do that. I'd never do that. It seemed far-fetched at the time, right? New team, we're going to create this value and all of that. And to be honest, we didn't really know how we were going to do it. So that was... and in some sense, the laughter, you know, echoed perhaps how I was feeling about what you, you know, what the scale of the challenge was. But in some sense, by challenging ourselves to do it, it gave us the license to actually get out there and prioritize what we were doing. We've done that 3 years in a row. Actually, in fact, this year we're going to make a lot more than the 100. What I would say then is, put yourself under pressure. Data scientists, go out there, put yourself under pressure. Put yourself under pressure to deliver.
Yes,
because that will make sure you do deliver. Put yourself under pressure to be to create the best outcome you possibly can.
Yeah,
right? Which won't be necessarily the most complicated, but the best outcome you can. Put yourself under pressure to create impact, right?
Yeah.
Because by putting yourself under pressure and having very mean people like Paul Lockwood laugh at you in public, in front of your peers, it puts yourself under pressure to go and deliver that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the worst thing in the world is for data scientists is to be told by their boss, do you know what? We really just want you to do some clever stuff and make the board look like they care about data science. There's nothing more depressing than that.
Yeah.
Put yourself under pressure because data scientists, analysts, they are bright enough to understand that making money is just an optimization problem.
Yeah. Nice. Lovely sign off, Harry. I like that. And I agree. The power of big, hairy, audacious goals. It's good to hear. That's great. Thanks for that. And many thanks for your time today, Harry. It's been a pleasure and enthralling to chat with you, as I knew it would be.
Thank you very much for asking me.
You're very welcome. And thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up from other data leaders. And each week, there's fresh content on our blog as well, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks, everyone, for your time. Have a good week. And however locked down you are right now, stay safe, keep well, and maybe put yourself under pressure. Bye for now.